I don't exactly know the best way to proceed on this book. I do want to give you all the chance to sort of bring up the sections that were most meaningful to you, because I doubt if we can go, you know, letter by letter here. But before I start that, there's a few introductory things I wanted to say, partly based on some feedback I got from last week, which I don't know how entirely relevant it is or not. After I went home from this class last week, I was sort of trying to tune in to what the energy had been, and I realized how very different it is from the other two series that we did. The other two books that we did were very philosophical, because of the way Swami presents philosophy, and it's also very practical. But still, it was a wonderful exercise, but it was a little bit, it wasn't every day. Gyanamata's book is really about a very here and now experience of life. And it has this immediate, one gets caught in the contrast between the way she suggests people live and the way she lived herself, with perhaps maybe a teeny weeny bit the way we're living. And I had several people tell me that even though they were eager to take this class, they felt a little dismayed because of the realization of the gap between what they were reading and what their habitual responses to life are. And so I sort of wanted to make sure that we work with that in the right way, because the capacity to be strong enough in yourself to see the top of the mountain and not be dismayed is a very important part of the spiritual path. But also, in fact, people's response to me was part of what I did say last week when I was introducing the class. And I said, what this book is really going to teach us is the difference between having a nice life and being a little bit spiritual and really getting on the spiritual path with self-realization as the goal. And so we just sort of want to work our way through all of that, which will make this class conceivably a lot less of a lecture class, a lot more of a discussion. We'll have to see which way it goes. So, the other part that I sort of wanted to introduce, just because here we are, the first chapter of this book is called Right Attitude. And in many ways, some of the most well-known quotes out of this book are right out of this chapter. And it's no coincidence that it's first, and it's no coincidence that some of the most useful things in the book are in this chapter. So I wanted to just spend a few moments really talking about the concept of attitude, because even though I guess attitude is even a slang word implied negative these days, if somebody has attitude, that means that they have a negative or kind of a cheeky attitude. But on the spiritual path, as Gyanamata says, and Master used to say too, attitude is everything. In one of the most recent chapters of the book that Swami Kriyananda is writing, of the Bible and Bhagavad Gita commentary, Intimations of Immortality. It's chapter maybe 24, I think it is, or 23. And he's written a chapter called How Devotees Fall, and then this chapter is called How Devotees Rise Again, meaning once you sort of find yourself out of sorts with your spiritual life, how do you recover again? And there's the opening paragraph of that chapter says something in essence like this. He says, whether a slip on the spiritual path, whether a fall on the spiritual path is merely a slip or a tragedy, depends entirely on your attitude. Now, isn't that an interesting statement? And so it's not, if you stop and sort of analyze it for a moment, I mean, all of us, if not in this lifetime, or maybe in this lifetime, but at least in previous lifetimes, have done all sorts of things that by any measure would be awful, and by any measure even on the spiritual path, we can have done very, very bad things. Swami Kriyananda, when we were in Italy, was sharing with some of us past life readings he had from this remarkable book called the Book of Bhrigu. Bhrigu was an ancient sage who wrote these very detailed summaries of people's lives, and for hundreds of years, people have been able to go to pundits who have this book, and they'll read from it, and they'll read about your past lives and your present life and your future life. Nowadays, unfortunately, it's very hard to find an honest pundit, because not everybody who comes has a reading, but if there's no reading, there's no pay. So now if you go to a pundit, there's always a reading for you, and if it wasn't Bhrigu's, then it was just created on the spot. But when Swami went 30 years ago, it was more legitimate. But he was told about lifetimes of his, in which, for example, he argued with his guru and then fell off the path, or made mistakes that resulted, as the pundit put it, in your sadhana becoming unsettled, and at the end of the life, you know, you sort of didn't end up where you'd hoped to be. I mean, you sort of see someone who has never missed his kriyas except twice when he was sick in 52 years, and you think that the person was born that way, and maybe they were, but they weren't always born that way. You know, many, many other experiences take place. But anything that you do, I was hearing today about reminded today of the story of Milarepa. Milarepa, the biographies of him say, Tibet's greatest yogi. And Milarepa is a very famous story and worth reading if you haven't ever read it. Milarepa's mother was swindled out of her property by nefarious relatives. So she prevailed upon her son, Milarepa, to study black magic so that she could have revenge upon her relatives. And as a strong-willed young man and a dutiful son, he studied black magic and became an excellent black magician, and actually destroyed the property and the lives of most of the people that had misused his mother. But then, having done that, he realized that he had acquired for himself a great deal of very bad karma, which he did not want to have. So he went off to expiate his sin by finding a guru who could really help him. And then he did so by very, very arduous labors. The story of Milarepa is having his guru instruct him to build a stone house in various locations, a huge stone house or a stone tower, you know, 7, 8, 9 stories high. And each time he almost had it constructed, his guru would say, well, I didn't tell you to put it there. I want it over on that other hill. And then he'd have to take it down and move it again. And it's quite a story. But at the end of it, he expiated all his bad karma and became a very great yogi. Now, I'm using that as an example because Milarepa did a lot of really bad things. But as soon as he shifted and decided that he didn't want to do them anymore, he ceased to be a bad person. He had to do something to expiate the karma, but he was no longer a bad person because he was no longer thinking and acting like one. Now, there's nothing that you can do, no matter how horrible, no matter what betrayal, what brutality, what murder or lying or immorality or anything that you do. As soon as you stop doing it, you're not it anymore. Do you see what I mean? It's like it's not really there once you cease to do it. In fact, Gyanamata makes reference in her book to the alternating thought forms of joy and sorrow, that they're just the shifts of the mind. And when the mind doesn't shift but remains calm, where do they go? They don't exist. You see, it's not as if there's any objective reality to joy now and sorrow later and resentment now and calmness. It's all just a shift of the mind. When the mind ceases to shift and remains calm, those states of consciousness disappear. Do you see? So in this sense, what we do only defines us so long as we're doing it. Now, of course, there is the factor of residual karma, karmic effect of that, which could make your life difficult, but it wouldn't affect you. You could be anything you want to be. So whether a fall on the spiritual path is merely a slip or a tragedy in the sense of really drawing you off the path, entirely depends on the attitude you have about what has happened to you. If you can accept it with equanimity, if you can be detached, if you can be calm, if you can have the right perspective, if you can forgive yourself, if you can use your willpower to not repeat it, then it just becomes something that happened. If you have the wrong attitude toward it, if it's all about guilt and blame and despair and a sense that God must hate me now and I'm unworthy, Those are all just, what are they? They're just attitudes of the mind. None of those actually have anything to do with the action itself. You can just take whatever action it was, no matter how awful, and look at it from all these different perspectives. And each of those perspectives, because once an action is done, it's behind you. You know, by very definition, by the time you're looking at it, it's no longer happening. Swami made the wonderful remark once. He said, if you have to judge yourself, which he said, I don't recommend anyway, he said, don't judge yourself by where you, what you've done or where you are. Judge yourself by where you're going, where you aspire to go, because that defines you much more truly. Anything that can already be measured is already behind you. So as soon as any action is over, all that's left of it is the attitude you have toward it. Whether you're egotistical, whether you're attached, whether you're living in the past, all of those different things, you see? So in fact, because all we really are, all there ever is to work with, is this moment. There's never anything but this moment. I mean, try really hard to find a moment other than this moment that you can actually be in. It's always now. It's the most fascinating and interesting part of life. I often think, you know, that there'll be that moment for all of us when we're lying on our deathbed, and it'll be the last breath, and it'll be just as absolutely now as it is right now. You know? So all you ever have is not the events of your life, really, but the way in which you relate to them. So if you relate properly, an attitude is the way you relate. If you relate properly, if you have the right attitude to the events and experiences of your life, then nothing can hold you back. Because we have to accept, we must accept, that we have all kinds of karma. And even though we're utterly sincere at this point, we have all kinds of karma, a little bit of what we remember, most of which we don't remember, but it's all here and it's all going to continuously act on us. We cannot guarantee, no matter how sincere or how determined our effort is in this moment, that nothing challenging, difficult, embarrassing, humiliating, everything, devastating, it will all happen to us. The only control we have is our attitude toward it. Okay? So that's why Gaudamata put so much effort, right, into just saying, think about how you relate to what happens. Because I was saying to a group last night, if we can get on the spiritual path, there really aren't that many things that we really have to know. Even though it may seem like a lot, but if we just can get a few little points down, then it's like we always know how to relate to every situation. And proper attitude is really the most fundamental. Because then really, make the big list. Whatever comes, you'll know what to do about it. Right? And then we don't have to be so confused so much of the time. Because we get this thought in our head that the details of what happened to us are very important. And we, you know, go to all sorts of places to get information, and we try to understand our past lives, and we ask people to do readings for us and tell us this and tell us that, and we spend hours analyzing. But after a while, you just begin to think, what difference does it make? Because all that really matters is how I am right now. Sister herself says that in this chapter. There was the rumor went around Mount Washington that Sister Gyanamata had been Saint Teresa of Avila in a former life, which Swami Kriyananda says simply, it makes a lot of sense. You know, the personality of the two women is extremely similar, and the enormously active life that Saint Teresa of Avila followed would be appropriately balanced by the life that Gyanamata lived, in the sense that Gyanamata was finished with that kind of work. And when you read their writings, they're just a lot alike. So in one of the little letters that we read for tonight's story, it said, she talks about the fact that, you know, I didn't really even want to ask you if X was true, because what difference does it make? You know? All that matters is my consciousness right in this moment. Now, a lot of times with us, we think, and sometimes it is true, I don't want to be too unequivocal on this one, that all the details are unimportant. But the only purpose of the details is to give us the strength to have the right attitude in the moment. And at a certain point, one really just loses interest in the details because you sort of figure that's the same job anyway. You know, the project is just like Gyanamata said, the project is just the same. So I have all this other stuff to work with. Still, I'm going to have to use my willpower and my determination to be in the right consciousness now. And sometimes it's better to use our energy that way directly instead. Now, that's my sort of general introduction for this evening. Does anyone have particular passages we'd like us to work with, or shall we just start at the beginning and go through it? Any favorites? Based on the assumption that we won't be with everything. What do you want? This is good? Okay. That's better? Sorry, I didn't mean to mess up the whole first part of it. Yes, Sister Gyanamata says, the gifts and graces of the soul must be acquired by patient daily practice. All will surely be yours in time. For if you do not obtain them in the position to which God has called you, where in all the world are they to be found? Now, you know, that's like, I've been making a sincere effort on the spiritual path since I first came to Ananda in 1971. And I can't tell you how many times in those decades the answer to something that was going on in my head was just that exact phrase. You know, because the soul, the ego can't help but think, it's just such an incredible temptation to imagine that the only reason that something is being done to us that isn't fair, and that somehow some too difficult obstacle is here, or instead of really looking at changing oneself, it's just so much easier to sort of look outside of ourselves and think that if only circumstances were different, then I would be better. Now, bear in mind, and we have to have the self-esteem and the confidence in ourselves to be able to read unequivocal statements like this and apply them with common sense. And in fact, I think later on in here, she speaks a little bit to that, because even though we say, if you can't find God in the position where you are right now, where do you ever expect to find him? That doesn't mean that you may never make a change in your life, or that you may never decide that it would be better for you if you were in different circumstances. But it's still, even if you're making a change in your life, you do it with the awareness, not that, oh, somehow I'm going to escape some karmic obligation. You see, again, because it's all in our attitude. We can be making changes because it's appropriate and natural from time to time to make changes. We don't just have to have endurance. We can also have creativity and initiative. I've observed among my friends and myself that there's not necessarily like two kinds of people, but people like myself who don't have a lot of endurance develop a lot of creativity. And I have other friends who seem to have less creativity because they have more endurance. You know, they get into a situation and they'll just stay there because they have the power to just stay there. I have very little power to just stay there, so I'm always thinking of new alternatives. You know, we sort of develop along our own natural lines. But even when one is thinking of new alternatives, one has to have the right attitude, which is not to imagine that somehow we're going to get away with something, escape from something. You know, it always has to be right there with us. She also says, just as I was talking, the very first letter, if I were to give you the gift that I would like best of all to offer you, it would be the right attitude. Because through her own life of really intense experience, that's what she figured out. And really start, you know, go home this week and think about it. Think how many times when you're suffering this week, in large or small ways, if you just changed your attitude, you wouldn't feel that way. You know, how much of it is really circumstantial and how much of it is just the way in which you regard your circumstances. Right? Any comments or any other ones that you would like us to talk about before we just turn the pages? Yes, Karen.
Maybe a little bit more in specific of that attitude.
Well, I think we'll find it as we go through. Okay, here's number one. The position in which you find yourself, God is not going to be any closer to you somewhere else. Okay? In other words, and she emphasizes this a lot, and you have to always think about it, nothing happens outside of God's will. I mean, everything is perfectly set up for you to learn the lessons you need to have the karma that's right for you. In the Festival of Light every week, we go through this little cycle with the little bird, remember? The bird has a great commission from the divine, and then he decides that God really doesn't know what he's doing, and he changes the plan and starts hoarding for himself instead of sharing generously, and that's the stage we call the revolt. And oftentimes, if we look very deeply into our own nature and are very honest with ourselves, we find that we're in a perpetual state of rebellion against the way things are, you know? And sometimes people even proudly say, I don't really want to be on this planet. Well, on one level, yes, but on the other level, by Jove, here we are, you know? And God has put us here, and if we can't develop spiritually right where God has put us, where do we think we will develop? And so that's a very good beginning, is just to remember that this has to be right because this was given to me. Now how you respond, whether you endure, whether you run away, whether you stand up for yourself, you know, all of those are different questions. But that you must deal with the position you're given rather than merely passively resent it, you know, is what Sister Gyanamata is starting with. Here I am because God put me here. Makes sense? It doesn't mean you have to be passive, though. It's a very important difference. Pam, are you going to raise your hand?
I think talking about that on page 78, February 1st, 36, when she said, I suppose no wrong action that I ever performed did as much to cloud my happiness, shut out the light of God, and hold back my spiritual progress as much as the wicked habit of holding on to a desire. It's not wrong in itself that was impossible to gratify.
Oh, yeah. That's an amazing one. These are so hard when you really read them. She says, I often talk to people, you know, people will come to me sometime. I mean, I talk to a lot of people, of course, and they'll come to me and they'll be really clear about something that they're upset about. But there's no way that there's nothing they can do about it. It's somebody else's reality or. And I often say to them, you know, you're right. And that's what makes it all the harder. And sometimes God's trick on us, that the desire is, there's nothing wrong with the desire in itself, you know, or the way we look at a situation, or wouldn't it be wonderful if so-and-so understood that this is how they really should behave, or all of these people did it, but I knew it was the right way, and they didn't listen to me. And, you know, it's just like that sort of like exquisite torture of it. Is that not only did it not come out the way, not only are we not getting what we want, but our way was better and right. And I think God, like, if you're wrong, at least you can just let go of it, because as she says herself, because we know we have to get over it, because we see what's wrong with it. You know, if we have a vindictive attitude or a resentful attitude, we can see that it's wrong. But if it was a right thing, and we still don't have it, because it's not, we're not here to have the pleasure of always having all our desires gratified. I mean, that's how, when I read this, that was what I began to think of. But she also talked about little things like, for in her own life, like having a room of her own, or having the people she liked, as she puts it to Diamata later, just stay in place, you know, so that her friends would always be around her. And we're often really justifying all those little things, that they're okay, that they harm no one, as she says in another place. And it's not as if we have to push ourselves beyond what is natural to us. And this is one of the things you have to balance when you read about Gyanamata. She was in the last years of her last incarnation. And therefore, every little tiny fiber of anything that interfered with her complete surrender to God was what was in front of her. You know, most of the rest of us have so many different things to work on, we don't really have to work on everything. We can just like put a little energy in a lot of different directions and it'll all move the project forward. She just was dealing with the last final thread. That's why in the same letter she says, I was so gratified when I went to the ocean with my friend to discover that I had surrendered even my desire for the ocean. And most of the rest of us would think, well, you know, for us, it's like the desire for the ocean is in lieu of the desire for a movie. I mean, like, we're upgrading. But for her, the only upgrade was nothing, was to surrender everything and then to go up into the infinite. But it still becomes useful for us. And this is where I was saying at the beginning, we have to think about how the principles apply on the level that we're on, which is just because the desire is a righteous one, or just because we're right, if God rejects it and does not give us a harmonious, dharmic way to have what we want, we have to recognize that it may not be ours to have anymore. Now, this is where we begin this process that I promised you of diverging between the ideas of psychology and the ideas of spirit. Because the psychological emphasis, especially nowadays, is very much on the importance of knowing what you want and going and getting what you want and all of this satisfy yourself sort of energy. You need to be happy. Now, it's not so simple as to say you need to be unhappy, don't go for anything that you want. But you have to always ask yourself, really, is this desire working in harmony with the divine energy flowing through me? Or is this desire strengthening my separation from what we sometimes say, what's trying to happen? And this is where Gaudamata writes, you know, that you hold on to a desire not wrong in itself, that was impossible to gratify, that just can't be yours. And then what do? At that point, then we start thinking like devotees. We start thinking, if God wanted me to have it, God would give it to me. And maybe at first those are just empty words to us. Swamiji, on a tape that I was listening to today, which was one of the treasures along the path, many of you subscribe to this monthly tape series and you just get various things in the mail. And it was called How to Trust God. And he starts by saying something very interesting. He said, before God will take care of you, he has to be sure that he can trust you. And what he meant by that was that we attract the support of the divine when we have the courage to rely upon it. And if we're really busy taking care of ourselves and then every 10th or 12th desire, when it's not working out, we turn around and sort of ask God to help us, we're not in a very magnetic relationship. So in this context, when we have a desire not wrong in itself that can't be gratified, that's when we have to start thinking like devotees. And we have to start saying, if this were truly good for me, God would give it to me. And if we've sincerely tried our best, and that's not contained in here, but it's implied in many other parts of Master's teachings, you know, Swamiji often says, if you really think you're right, don't give up. Which is sounds a bit like a contradiction, but try your hardest. Put forth the best possible effort. But when it becomes obvious that whatever it is you desire is not going to come to you, then you have to turn and have the right attitude about your disappointment. And the right attitude about our disappointment is everything belongs to God, nothing belongs to me. And it isn't right to hold on to something, and that's, again, where psychology may give you a slightly different answer. I don't mean to be broad-based, but you understand what I mean, you know, broadly condemning, but you know what I mean. Because you're not suppressing it if you surrender it. You see the difference? Suppressing it is when you still really think it's the right thing, but you don't get it. And then you just kind of take your feelings take your whatever it is and just kind of stuff it down, but deep down, you're still committed to it. To surrender something, to really let go, is to understand that, oh yes, it was a lovely thing in itself. It would have been beautiful if it happened, but God has something more beautiful in store for me. And so you may still even mourn it. You may still even feel very sad about it. But nonetheless, there's no level, there's no conflict within you about it, or there's an understanding of what you're doing, a real understanding of what you're doing, that God will take care of me if I go along with what's been given to me instead of always trying to fight for my own will. Does that make sense? It's a very, very important point, because so often in our lives we just don't get it. We don't get what we want, I mean. Over and over and over again, we don't. And sometimes it's a good thing for us, but not always. I mean, sometimes it's just a profound disappointment. That's just the way it is. But then we say, well, it's an exercise in letting go. Just have the right attitude toward it. Consider it an exercise in just relinquishing something that is not going to be yours anyway. You know? Does that make sense? I look at you, Pam, and forgive me for thinking of this, but of course I was thinking of your husband dying a couple of years ago and the hope, you know, that he would get well. A desire not wrong in itself, but not meant to be gratified. You know? Lovely, it would have been lovely if he had recovered, but he didn't. You know? So then you have to say, well, even that desire, even though on its own terms, what's wrong with it? It's not meant to be, so it has to be let go of. Any other thought? Any other questions or thoughts or paragraphs to deal with? Yes.
Three things to keep in mind, and one of them was unruffled patience.
Right.
Do you have any practical tips?
Well, she's full of them. What? Where are you? Can you remember?
I don't know where exactly.
Okay.
Sort of the
yeah, you know, unruffled patience. Everything on the spiritual path works together. And you can't be patient if you don't have calmness in your mind. And it's very hard to have calmness in your mind unless you can concentrate or lift your mind above the mundane. So she gives advice in many other places, you know, read the lives of the saints, meditate, chant, pray, be in good company. Don't expose yourself to unsettling influences. You can't just sort of start with like one piece. Oh, I think I should be patient. Because you can't. You have to ask yourself, what am I doing with all of my life all the time? Am I constantly infusing my life with influences which will make it calm? Or am I filling my mind with influences that will make it constantly impatient? And also, the answer that I give, that I've given 100 times, is you always have to practice when it's easier. You know, I drove with a friend once that was just so impatient in traffic. Oh, why don't, he should get out of the way, you know, it's my turn, why does he do that? Oh, I hate drivers like that. And I thought to myself, well, what do you do when you have a big problem to face? You know, and sometimes people will say, well, I let it all out, you know, in traffic. But the main thing is, it becomes a habit of the mind. And so you have to be constantly vigilant. Now see, Gyanamata sets us a perfect example because of the fact, as I was saying earlier, that she cleared the deck and there was almost nothing left. So it was just these little tiny remnants of things. And so we sort of have the thought that a lot of things don't matter because it's not clear to us always what does matter. But the way you have to think of it is it's always the moment. It's always the present. It's always the now. And everything in future is nothing but an accumulation of all the reactions you've had until that moment. Even as we sit here now, our consciousness is simply the result of all the moments that have come before it. And so if we want to be able to be calm and patient in the face of great catastrophe, we have to learn to be calm and patient in the face of very small catastrophe. You know, because that trains, that orients the mind. in whatever direction it's going to go. So there's never a time when we're justified in not being attentive. I smile. We belong to the Palo Alto Ministers Association, and a lot of churches sort of, they don't exactly close for the summer, that would be too big a word, but they kind of go on sabbatical a lot in the summer. Admittedly, because many of the clergy people are not as fortunate as we are to have such a broad-based support and so much staff and other clergy people to help them. But nonetheless, I think there's no vacation from self-realization. You can't just stop for the summer because every moment is equally important. There really isn't a moment that's less important than another. It's a marvelous thing to contemplate, really. Because if you can't find God in the position in which you've been placed right now, where do you ever expect to find Him? You see how it fits together? All right. Any other paragraphs to work with? Yes, Kumari? Right. Oh, because in fact, practically speaking, Kumari, it was. It was very sick. And there was the point at which she had to retire from all mostly active service in the last, I don't know how many years, maybe at least 10. She was just an invalid. And so she really literally couldn't do anything. So she has a letter in here, you know, about right attitude toward the body, asking the question of, you know, like, why do I have this body? What use is it? Because the only purpose she could see for living was to serve Master's work, and so why was she still alive if she couldn't do anything? I mean, she wasn't lamenting it. She was just raising the question. But then, again, she just had the same consciousness of it. Well, she knew, I mean, this is so dear, but you know, she knew that Master had a bargain with Divine Mother and that she would stay alive only as long as Master wanted her to stay alive. I believe that she was aware of that. I believe she knew she was living on His grace. So she had to just say, there's nothing. She had heart problems, she had arthritis, she had a kidney condition, she had, those are the ones that, yeah. So she really meant literally it was useless. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite understand you. Satan? Uh-huh. And, oh, she writes about, the one who writes about being possessed or getting involved in negative spirits. Yeah. Thank you, that helps. Well, that was an amazing part, and I find it very interesting that they stuck that in here. You know, in the Bible, Jesus is dealing with that. You know, Master actually talked a good bit about tramp spirits and astral entities and made it seem like it was much more common than... Well, it has many levels. I mean, in this particular instance, they're specifically talking about what Master calls tramp souls, souls that die, people who die. I mean, we're just talking about people. You have to realize... These are just people without bodies. You know, we're people with bodies, they're people without bodies, they're nothing else than that. But if a person dies and leaves the gross material plane and has to go into the world where it's more subtle, if they don't have the refinement of consciousness to even have any karma to be on such a subtle plane, several things will happen. One is, Master said, they never really wake up. That they just go into a what he called like a gray sleep. I mean, these are people who are not terribly evil, but people whose lives are just defined by materialistic experiences. You see them all over the place. You just look at some people's faces and they just don't have anything beyond their body and what they can experience through it. So but such people will die and they can't wake up in the astral world because there's nothing for them to relate to. So they'll just have kind of a semi-conscious dream state. They'll rest. And Master said they won't really wake up until they're back in a body. And then they'll become conscious again. And they'll sort of start experiencing through a body, and then they'll be awake again because there's something for them to do. Just like you can see a person who gets really bored and depressed and doesn't notice much that's going on. A refined person, when they get out of their physical body, will just be delighted at the freedom of the higher vibration of the astral world. But then Master talked about these sort of people in between who are so attached to their bodies that even as their bodies are dying, they can't leave. So they hang around the physical universe. And even though there are angels trying to draw them away from that, the movie Ghost was a little bit about that, remember? When he died and the light was behind him, but he became so absorbed in the woman he was leaving behind that he got stuck for a while until finally they were able to get his attention and get him to go into the light. Well, some souls are just so interested in the physical world and so anxious. I mean, you can aberrate. What I'm trying to say is it's not automatic. And they're so anxious to experience physical reality again and so unwilling to cooperate with the natural process that they look for bodies that they can experience through. And that's where she talks about if you made your mind negative, if you got involved in these seances, if you did things that put you on that vibration, there's tramp souls waiting to crowd your consciousness out and take possession of your body. That's what it is to be possessed, literally. And that's what Jesus seemed to have run into a lot of them. You know, he was always driving those souls out. So Gaudamata, I mean, naturally she would speak strongly and decisively and definitely if you find yourself in there. Now, even if you're not possessed, those kind of dark entities hang around if your consciousness is low. That's why it's important that things be clean and beautiful and orderly, because lower astral entities are attracted to disorder, to dirt, to confusion. And as a result, that's why such places have bad vibes. You feel the bad vibes because lower unrefined spirits are comfortable in that environment, so they hang out in that environment. You go in and it has bad vibes. I remember many years ago, Swami Chidananda came to Ananda Village in the very early years, and it was very tamasic. It was very messy in lots of places, and he scolded us very definitely. He said, "You've got to clean this place up." He said, "You have all these lower astral entities who are drawn to all this stuff, and you've got to get it out." It's a very interesting statement. So Gaudamata, of course, you know, really goes strongly. Not to get into that stage, because if you don't become actually possessed, you'll become influenced, and you don't want to become influenced. And she also gives, you know, the very specific straight om is the great defense against negative forces. And this factor that Master said of, if you have an inclination to be bothered, that you write om on your pillow at night. Master said that very specifically. That was his advice she was giving. So that when you put yourself into subconsciousness, you put yourself into the om. Well, the other one, I mean, the letter before, which has so much in it, she talks about, she also, again, gave this a psychology. This is the letter on page 81. Where the man says, "You speak of your tendency toward melancholy as being hereditary." And then in her simple, unequivocal way, she says, "This is a mistake." And she just says it so simply. We do not suffer for the wrongdoing of others, only for our own. Meaning, I mean, I never exactly thought of it just like that, but just because your parents had the karma to have these bad qualities, you don't get them because of them. You get them because of you. Yes, exactly. It completely works backwards, but it's very tempting to believe. It's just so tempting to believe because there's so many obvious connections in cause and effect relationships between the things that happen to us and the way we've become, that we have to constantly remind ourselves that we would never have come into those influences if it wasn't already our tendency to be that way. So in this letter, Gaudamata just sort of dismantles that whole, I am this way because I have this mental condition that I inherited that's genetic, I have this physical condition, I had to deal with this kind of an abusive situation, everyone in my family has a tendency toward X, Y, and Z. It doesn't mean that you can't know those things or pay attention to those things. Swami Kriyananda says it perfectly in The Path when he's giving the history of his family. And he says, I tell you these things because, not because I think they define me. And then he uses the sentence. He says, I came into this life fully myself. And I think he's talking both about himself and about people in general. He said, I describe them to give you an idea of the forces and conditions and attitudes with which I chose to associate. And that's really a very wonderful way to look at it. I've always really enjoyed that. And I've certainly learned a great deal about myself by looking at my family. Because often characteristics run in families, and often delusions are passed down through families. Arbitrary attitudes that you think of as truth are passed down through families. I have been mortified to learn in the last couple of years fundamental things about myself that I didn't know just by watching my family. And finally having it occur to me that the whole world isn't like this. This is just my family. But this is how I always thought the whole world was, because this is the subconscious conditioning I received. And the other aspect of that which I've really observed is that, because I asked myself once, because certain of my worst characteristics were really intensified by the family that I was raised in. You know, I just sort of, we all went together down the wrong roads. And I thought to myself, what a stupid thing for me to do. Why didn't I get born into a family that would have balanced me out? But I could see that because the family exacerbated those qualities, they got so bad that I noticed, right? And so very often we're born to make things worse and worse. And so that's the tendency then to blame. But really, the life conditions are making things worse and worse and harder for us, because we have to always get pushed to the end before we'll turn and fight back. You know, the tendency just to go along, it's so hard to get ourselves together to fight back. But then we have to steadfastly listen to Gyanamata. To say that something is hereditary, this is a mistake. Right? She doesn't give you any margin on it, does she? Just, this is a mistake. So, what does she say? I loved when she says, whenever we see that some habit, mental or physical, is dragging us down, at that very instant, we ought to begin the fight against it. Now, bear in mind, she knows that you can't fight the whole battle all at once. So often, the beginning of the battle is just the first realization that I don't have to be this way. You know? In the first battle, first there's the causal, then there's the astral, then there's the physical. You know, the manifestation of our intention may take time, but merely because it takes time doesn't mean that it doesn't begin with just that intention. And the beginning of it also is what she says here. Don't feel just because you were always this way and your family was always this way that this is you. This is just the forces you chose to associate yourself with. And if you see now that it's a bad habit, begin in that very moment the process of repudiating it and adopting a new one. And don't think that that will happen just like that. I always say, it took us a really long time to get this mixed up. You know? I think it's important, as I often put it, you have to respect delusion. You have to see what a formidable foe it is, or else you'll get discouraged. If you really know how hard and long the fight is, you're ready for it. And if you're dealing with something like this gentleman was dealing with, this long tendency to feel a certain way, you have to respect that. You know, that you've spent a long time working yourself into this position. So now you have to start the long process of undoing it. But right in the moment, now this is Gyanamata's attitude, right in the moment when you realize that this habit isn't what you want, begin the fight. Just begin the fight right then. Begin the resolution. I will overcome this. And even if it's just words or thoughts or almost nothing behind it, nonetheless, the power of your success will be built from that first little step, step by step. And she often says in this book, I know because I did it. You know, this is the process I followed, because I'm sure everyone looked at her and thought, oh, but you're so free. How do you think I got here? She says, by doing exactly what I'm telling you to do. All right. Any other? Yes, Doris. Yeah. Right. Yeah, if you're in a dark room, how do you get rid of the darkness? And you have to think of your own consciousness that way too. If you're in a dark space, how do you get rid of it? And that's where you have to also fight against the tendency to fall into greater darkness because you have darkness. Do you see the folly of it? But it's so tempting. Satan tries to persuade us that that's the best way. The way you get rid of darkness is to bring in the light. So whenever you find yourself in a dark situation, doing the wrong thing, try to do something else other than what you're doing. You don't worry about it, just try to do something else. Somewhere in here she says, Master's advice to lose yourself in a good book. You know, just do something else, because here I am in darkness. Many times I remember telling a woman friend of mine who had some very bad habits with her mind, that she just had to recognize she just couldn't stay there. I mean, she just had to get up and run around the block. It didn't really make any difference what she did. She just had to not do that. And so whenever you find yourself in the darkness, ask yourself, if the room was dark, how would I make it light again? You know, would I just walk around, as she says, cursing the darkness, which is what we do if we recognize a flaw in ourselves, a fault in ourselves that we don't like, and we weep and wail and cry and feel terrible, which we all do, just feel awful and depressed and so on. I mean, if it was a dark room, would that work? You know, just ask yourself, is this really practical? Where is this taking me? And then you have to bring in the light, whatever it might be. It's just, again, you see, it's so simple when you say it. But the next time you're in a mood, the next time you do something, do something that's just so distressing to us that we can hardly stand it, you know, and we just really want to go down into that place, remember this. How do you get rid of the dark? You bring in the light. And just ask, am I doing that? Am I enjoying this? Am I having a good time with this one? What did Gyanamata say? Oh yes, bring in the light. But you can see that from this moment until your moment of self-realization, you can solve every single bad mood by just remembering that. It's not hard. It's not a complicated thought. See, it's not that the spiritual path is easy, but it's actually very simple. And one of the things Gyanamata does is she makes it so simple. It's just a few very simple principles. And we have to not get confused in our own minds to think it's complicated, because it's not easy. And so when we get into that mood and we want to then analyze it and think about it and talk about it and worry about it and confide in our friends and journal and all these different things, maybe that'll help. But maybe we just want to bring in the light and forget it. You know, just forget it. It's not even worth dealing with. Just forget it. I don't mean suppress it. I don't mean fear it. I mean forget it. You know, just turn on the light. Not an issue anymore. Then we don't have to agonize about why I feel so guilty, because I don't. You see, it's just a delusion of the mind. Okay, any other paragraphs to work with? Yes, Sharon. Right.
A stranger came up to her and said, you know, something about you needed that to breathe, and said, well, they glorify
it.
It also made me think of the affirmations from the healing affirmations. I will go forth and participate in the power of all my senses to bring me what I need at the time I need it.
Right.
And I said it for a long time before it occurred to me that
didn't say what I want. I wanted what I mean. And so...
Nor does it say, we always say that affirmation, meaning all good things. I go forth in perfect faith, the power of omnipresent good to bring me all good things at the time I need them. I mean, it's just implied in your subconscious that that's why you're saying it, right? You know, the saints don't make a big distinction, I was saying this last night, between good karma and bad karma. They just call it karma. You know, good and bad is based on a very, very small little picture of pleasure and pain, based on a very, very small perspective. But what is pleasure and what is pain? Is it really, you know, to have everything go your way and just always have a happy little scene, is that really good karma? You know, it depends on what you're trying to get out of life. If you're trying to stay subconscious for as long as possible, you know, and have nothing challenge you and just have a, not that any of us ever have that anyway, but you know, what is your goal? And it's just so, that was what Swami Kriyananda said here in this temple, about here, on this standing about here, he said, we were right in the middle of the horrible trial and the terrible newspaper publicity, and he was being just vilified in the press and the courtroom by his own people. I mean, it was a living nightmare. It was a very difficult experience. And he was not having a good time. He was having some real dark days himself about it. But then he stood here and said, you know, I was thinking about this. He said, God has sent this to me so that I may become liberated. He said, you know, the purpose of this experience is for me to overcome all limitation and become God-realized. I mean, these weren't his exact words, but that's what he was saying. He said, and this is part of that. He said, so I realized, so he said, I had gotten far enough to say that I accept this. I accept that this was what God is giving me. He said, but I realized that I should love it. You know, and Sister Gyanamata calls it, so then glorify it. But the point is just the same. You have to look, okay, folks, this is attitude. What is it that I'm really trying to do here? If everything that I really wanted to have happen blows up in my face, why would I be disappointed? Well, we're disappointed because the ego has this idea of what's pleasure and what's pain. But why did we come? Why are we here? Are we here just so the ego will really just always feel comfortable? Or are we here so that we can feel in bliss forever? Now, isn't it possible that just a teeny weeny few of the things that we're attached to really are not going to go with us all the way to heaven? You know? Just a few of our ideas might be wrong. So when they start getting ripped to shreds, and our natural impulse is to feel that we are being ripped to shreds and something bad is happening to us, remember what Sister Gyanamata said. Why not? Of course, we live on many levels, but at least some part of us, I was talking to someone not too long ago, was going through a very difficult period, and I said, you know, here's where this experience has happened, and here's where the truth is. Just that little difference between the eyes being level, looking at the world, and the eyes looking up just that little bit to the spiritual eye. You know? So we look out on the world and we deal with the mess, whatever it might be that we're having to deal with. But then when we just can't deal with it anymore, we look up to the spiritual eye and we see where it's taking us. You know? What difference does it make? Sister Gyanamata says, what happens to us doesn't make any difference. All that matters is what we become. That's the step one, is to accept it. Step two is to glorify it. Thank you, Lord, for this wonderful opportunity to become free. That's the wonderful quotation from Sister Saint Teresa, you know, when she was crossing the river in the middle of winter and the little wagon she was upset in the cold rushing water and she was nearly drowned in the freezing river, and she found herself on the other bank miraculously dry and safe, and Jesus appeared to her and said sweetly, oh, Teresa, don't worry, that's how I treat all my friends. And Teresa said, ah, my Lord, no wonder you have so few. But that's just the right spirit, isn't it? Oh, that's how he treats all of us, because he wants us to be free. Mother really loves the child. Oh, you're the meanest mother in the world. How many children say that? You're the meanest mother. But then that's the best mother sometimes. Why don't we take a short break? Let's take about 10 minutes, then we'll come back for a little bit more. compulsion to be good. And I tried very hard to give this extremely tortured psychological explanation. Well, Cyrus showed me another sentence just a little way down, which tells me that I was totally wrong. And I think it's an edited sentence. I mean, I don't think Master actually said those words in that way. But later on in that same section, Master says, in pain there is a compulsion. Persuasion and love are better ways to get human beings back to heaven. So I believe what Master was actually saying is that God sends people pain in order to compel them to improve themselves. We suffer and therefore we become motivated to change. And Sister had a lot of suffering, but it wasn't because God was trying to motivate her to be good. She was already good. And that's what I think it meant. We worked out this whole other thing, which I repudiate. Okay. That's why her suffering was other people's karma, because there was no growth for it. She didn't need to have that in order to grow. The image that I've always played with in my own self is either you have to run of your own free will toward the light, or else your fanny's going to catch fire and you're going to have to run anyway. And sometimes the fire is trying to light your fanny, and if you just keep ahead of it, you know, and you never really have to go up and smoke. And if you just try to sit, you will catch fire because you can't stand still. So in Sister Gaudamata's life, if she'll forgive me for being so rude about her life, she didn't need to suffer. She was already totally engaged in the quest for perfection. Whereas the rest of us often need a little bit of a shove. All right. Okay, does anyone else have any other? Yes.
I just remember that she was a Gyani. That whole thing just kind of puts, you know, her life in the way she said that it would look better from the spectator's point of view.
Right, because she...
Nothing else but what was true.
Right.
And she had no other space for what wasn't true.
Right, exactly. The power of her life was her understanding. And when she saw the right way, that was it for her. But of course, we all have to be all of them. We have to be devoted. We have to be gyanic. We have to be serviceful. We have to meditate. We have to do everything. And so she does present for us. But you know, Master said devotion through wisdom is really what he called her, because she was so heartfelt, but her mind was the servant of her heart. It wasn't that her heart was smaller than her mind, but the mind was the servant of the heart. You know, during the break, someone was asking me about the, and we'll find this especially next week, you know, the extent and depth and magnitude of Sister Gyanamata's devotion to Master, and the way in which she just had no limit to her gratitude, and calls him, you've read it already. If I talk too much about this, is next week a little bit, so I might want to save this, but at a certain point, as one begins to progress spiritually, you see, the ego thinks that it's doing things. The ego thinks that it's in charge. And as long as we're in ego consciousness, we think we're doing it. And when... But the very definition of beginning to grow spiritually is beginning to recognize what an illusion the ego is, and how, in fact, we're really just instruments of higher consciousness. And so we begin to sense that everything that happens to us, everything that takes place, is really a descent of divine power into us. And this kind of magnificent appreciation of that begins to replace all sense of self. And specifically, the source for the devotee is the guru, because that's how the divine works. God doesn't come to us sort of all, you know, just from nowhere. The world is very orderly, and the energy passes through instruments. And so the guru is the the window through which the sunshine hits the devotee. And it's the sunshine that's hitting the devotee, but it's the window of the guru that has focused that on you. So the devotee begins to get all of these understandings all at the same time of one that all this, it's the image that someone gave once, which I loved, it's like we're all made out of tin foil. And so we seem to be shiny. And we think that we're the source of all this shininess that we see radiating from us. And it's only after a while that we realize that we're just reflecting something that's coming from somewhere else. And so where we had all this pride in being made out of tinfoil, we suddenly recognize that what we really need to be is exceedingly grateful that the light shines on us and allows there to be light at all. So the more the ego recedes, the more thrilled you become at the realization of your nothingness, especially in relationship both to the sunlight and to the lens which is focusing that sunlight on you. And of course, Master himself, as he himself said, I killed Yogananda long ago. No one dwells in this temple now but God. And when he was praised for his humility, he said, how can there be humility when there is no sense of self? Yogananda knew himself to be nothing but a window for the sunlight of the divine. So when Gyanamata extravagantly and without any limitation expresses her gratitude and her love and her appreciation, Yogananda knows that they're both celebrating the sunlight that's shining through, and there's no part of him that misunderstands it. But that that extravagance of both appreciation and recognition of the guru's role is really the secret of our liberation, because as long as we resist that, we're clinging to some little falsehood of who and what we are. And that was the great secret of her freedom, was that she recognized she was able to merge with him and let go of all other parts, and he had merged with the infinite, so she went straight through him to the infinite. It's a wonderful example. Yes.
She recommended a letter to Dayamata to express that extravagant devotion to Master specifically in writing. Do you think that she would still say to do that now, even
Well, one could write one's own journal, and Gyanamata herself kept a journal. The purpose of doing that is it brings it to a clear focus. And the more clear focus it is in you, the more power there is. The more power there is, the more there is a chance of making a real connection. So I would think it would be a very valid thing to do. I mean, I never had thought about it myself even until you said it just now. But otherwise, things remain amorphous for us. I mean, everyone who ever tries to write recognizes that you can think you know what you want to say, but until you actually try to put it in words, you often don't. And so you may think you have a clear concept of how you want to relate to Master, but if you tried to write it, you might find out that you could bring it to a clearer focus within yourself. So I think it could be very valid. I'm not quite sure why she said that to Daya. I sort of read that and slightly wondered, why did she say to write it down often? I think partly to affirm it, for Daya herself to affirm it, for her not to lose track because she was obviously in a conflict during that period of time between her desires and her habits and her relationship to Master. And so I think Gyanamata wanted to make sure that she constantly, by having to stop and write, she would constantly affirm within herself her appreciation, because the reading between the lines of what was happening there, and in Durgamata's book, she talks about this, that Daya, there were a few of these women, Daya, Anandamata, and Rinalini, and they were quite young. They were young for a long time. They weren't young forever. But they were almost always with Master. He would just have them with them a lot. And maybe I'm overstating that because I don't really know, but they were often with him in person. And they grew quite accustomed to that. They served him personally, and they were just used to being in his company. And then Master gave Dayamata an assignment to be in charge of Mount Washington, which meant that when he went to Encinitas, she couldn't come because she had to stay at Mount Washington and be in charge of Mount Washington. And it was very difficult for her to, because the context also is, you see, for her, I'm extrapolating from what's here, but I can imagine, you know, there was no reality. She was a teenage girl when she came in. There was only one reality, and it was Master. She repudiated everything, and that was that, and was in this relationship of very personal service to him. And then all of a sudden, her service to him became more impersonal. And that's why Gyanamata says, ah, this is a great blessing, because you will find out what of your relationship to Master was personal and what was, and what is spiritual. And of course, that stands in this incredible contrast. I mean, you have to weigh that in the light of Gyanamata's profound understanding that she had to repudiate everything personal. This is, it's just such an unusual aspect of Gyanamata's nature that not only did she try to remain impersonal, but she actually tried to remain out of his presence. Where you would think that you would want to be in the presence of the guru, she tried not to be in the presence of the guru because she didn't want to have anything that wasn't purely spiritual between them. And Daya had so many levels of involvement with Yogananda on many different levels, and he treated her at first more, he gave her what she needed, but then when he saw that she was strong enough, he began to wean her and ask something else of her. And that was the terrible dilemma that Gyanamata was addressing at that point. You know, if SRF were different than they were, you'd sort of hear a lot more about the real life experiences of these devotees, you know, what they had to really go through. So, yes, Rick?
We think that this ego has been liberated.
Oh, we think the ego is going to go with us, yeah. We think that spirituality will feel just like, I mean, we'll be self-realized just as we are. Yeah, no, we won't. It feels different. Yeah. At the same time, it feels just the same in the sense that it's always now and you're always yourself. So for some reason, I find that so. When I was part of the monastery and we used to go every morning to this little teepee and meditate together, you know, we did that for about 8 or 9 years. I used to have these oddest thoughts, like, we go in there as one person, why don't we get all mixed up and come out as somebody else? You know, like, I would go in as myself and come out as Arati, or Sabo would go in and come out as Anandi, you know, just like, sort of, it all gets mixed up, but you always walk out and you're still yourself. You've still got your consciousness attached to this body and this ego. It's so powerful. But then Yogananda said at the end of his life, as Swami describes it, walking and sort of stumbling a little, and Yogananda said, I'm in so many bodies, sometimes I forget which one I'm supposed to keep going. And just think about that. You know, most of us don't usually forget which one we're supposed to keep going. But he, you know, just, it's an arbitrary identification here. And of course, Gyanamata being so much beyond that, the proximity of her particular body to Yogananda's particular body, that wasn't where the relationship was happening. It was just happening somewhere else entirely. Yes. And she would literally hear his voice. You know, there's that story later on where she says one of the nuns was taking care of her and she just repeated what Master was saying somewhere else. I mean, she just heard him. You can hear the Master's voice in your head. He's always there. When Yogananda said, I know every single thought every one of you is thinking, and the Swami said he proved it many times, I just said to Swamiji, it was a sort of a dumb question, but I said, is that still true? Someone sort of looked at me with the look of that being sort of a dumb question, but also appreciated. He just simply said, of course. Just like that, of course. You know, you can hear Master speak in your mind, just literally speak in your mind, if you put your mind to it. You know, we're so busy thinking our own thoughts that we don't hear it. We want so many other things other than to hear him that we don't hear him. But we can. It's right there to be heard. Something to look forward to, huh? Okay, other questions? Yes, John.
There's no answer to this, but it's still in reading this. The fact that she, irrespective of which saint she was, and her master definitely said she wasn't, has been a saint in the previous incarnation, it just starts to astonish. She had gone through this rather long life searching for truth, when previously she obviously was an elevated saint. And I don't know, it's just a funny feeling of the fact that she had to go through all this searching and everything. And then finally she's with Master at a very advanced, not very advanced Master, but you know, she was older and not in very good health at that point at all. It seemed like that entire span of doing this, I don't know, I don't want to say a waste.
No, but John, but what you're saying is, it's a divine mystery, you don't know. We have all these neat little pictures in our minds of how it ought to be. And I don't know why things happen the way they are, but I know one reason they happen the way they are, so that we'll get out of our neat little pictures. But clearly, you know, from, she said herself that, you know, from a very young age, and like four was when she talks about it, she could not remember a single thought in which God was not central. So she was totally devoted from the time she was conscious enough to be devoted. And she also describes, remember, in the biography of her own words, she says, at a certain point, she didn't have a master, but she decided to behave as if she did and everything was coming from him. And who knows what internal reality she was really having and what little bits of karma she might have been working out. I mean, she married this man, she had a son. Were these like, I don't know, are these like little bitty bits of desire that she still had that she needed to go through and find out about? Swamiji talks about certain things that, you know, thoughts that he's had, that desires or lingering wishes that he had in his heart that he doesn't have at all anymore because of the experiences of this life. Just certain little delusions that just were just an undercurrent there. But you know, when Sister Gyanamata died, was dying, the Master went in and said, "Do you have any desires left? If you do, I will fulfill them for you now." "No, sir, none." He asked her three times. She said, "No, none." Would you have been able to say that before that incarnation started? I don't know. But whatever life experience she had, she was able to say, "No, there's none." It's an amazing thought, but when you just think how completely casually we allow our desires to run us. Just, you know, all day long. What are we doing all day long? We're just following through on this, following through on that. Oh, I have a gift certificate at Ross's. I think I'll go and see if they have a this. You know, oh yeah, I don't like the buttons on that so-and-so. I'll go get some new buttons. I mean, I'm just describing my day-to-day. You know? It's like, I'm just sitting there, everything's fine, and then this little desire kind of wiggles itself up, and whoosh, I'm just, you know, I'm in my car. Just following it through for a little while. Just over and over and over and over again. But, you know, she just had whittled all those things down. What is it really? All I really want to do is just serve God. What else is there? She didn't have a room of her own. She slept on an army cot. She hung her stuff in, you know, in the attic. Because it was, she just whittled it all the way down. I don't even need to see the ocean. What do I want? Because all everything is to us is the inner desire for bliss. You know, you have to ask yourself, what do I think this is going to give me? And what it's always going to give us, some little reflection of the inner desire, the inner bliss. That's all we can ever experience. You don't really, I mean, it doesn't do anything. It just doesn't have any life. I remember sharing with you all when we got a new carpet in our apartment, which is really a beautiful carpet, and I love it. We just spent so much time working our way to get that carpet, and when it was finally there, it was just there, you know? It was just a total inanimate object. It had no capacity to love me back, not the slightest. You know, and there had just been all this investment and all the joy it was going to give us. And I mean, it's very nice. I'm very glad we have it, but it doesn't love us back. There's no consciousness in it. And it's all just a question of what we're going to feel from God within ourselves. And that's what her life was, so perfectly. And it's not that we can, Swamiji advises us on a practical level, it's not that you can't have those desires, but everything that you enjoy, refer it back, is how he put it. I love that phrase. Refer it back to the inner joy. And let whatever pleasure you get in the world or joy you get from anything, let it feed the inner joy. Instead of considering it something separate, consider it just be another opportunity to feel more and more inner bliss. And at the same time, when things cause you to suffer, refer that also to the inner joy. You know, so that everything becomes, this becomes, the inner self becomes the reality, and everything else is seen in relation to that. And then you live, because the masters live, the saints live, but they live from the inside first. Because that has to, that has the capacity to love you back. Yes, Jillian.
You said that the last image is the image of God, and even in her last few years, she couldn't because of her illness. And I just been wondering what reason she might have been through.
Well, she herself, they refer to the fact that as she lost the capacity to do anything, it didn't cause any ripple in her consciousness. Whereas so many people define themselves by all the ways that they're useful, she simply defined herself by whatever came. I mean, to serve, in her case, was to please Master. That's all she wanted to do, was to please Master. And if it pleased, if Master wanted her to be alive and be sick, then that's what she would do. And it's nothing, that's the secret. I mean, I've often made reference to Teresa, Mother Teresa, whom people think was devoted to serving the poor. She wasn't devoted to serving the poor. She was devoted to doing what Jesus asked her to do. And as long as Jesus wanted her to serve the poor, she served the poor. But she didn't care about serving the poor. She cared about doing what Jesus asked her to do. As long as that was the request, she did it with her whole heart. Yogananda asked Gyanamata to stay in her body. So she was serving. Of course she was serving by her consciousness. Of course she was serving by... Yogananda said she had disciples. She was liberating other people. She was serving by example. She was serving through her vibration. She was uplifting the whole place. She was planting spiritual magnetism that people will feel for the ages. I mean, what we run around and do really makes no difference at all. It's our consciousness that we're serving with anyway. You can do all the right things, but with the wrong consciousness, and you really contribute nothing anyway. So it's entirely by consciousness. That's why she was so at ease when all the everything external was taken away from her. Because she was only doing that because that's what God gave her to do. If you can't find God in the position in which he has placed you, where do you expect to find him? And she says in here too, when she talks about the body, she has those wonderful lines. You know, you give up concern for the body, but you don't give up caring for the body. Because if you don't care for the body, then irresponsible things happen. But it was just such a perfect nuance of difference. You know, so she cared for the body as long as it was there, but she wasn't concerned about it.
Is it development, treatment of the body too? I mean, like yoga, posture, things like that, and isn't the body kind of a component?
I read in Moments of Truth from Autobiography of a Yogi, man's first responsibility is to keep his body well, because if his body isn't well, his mind loses the capacity to focus and do yoga. It was very interesting. It was just a very flat statement, you know. It's at first responsibility. And that's why if you read Master's teaching, really lots of other things that are not necessarily systematically published, there's an enormous emphasis on physical health. Because the willpower, because you see, we need something to work with. Otherwise, our spirituality becomes really vague. So the necessity to remain youthful and dynamic, oh, eternal youth of body, mind, and soul, abide in me forever and forever. That's what we say when we energize. And Yogananda's actual contribution to the science of yoga was the energization exercises, which was an original contribution. But none of that applied to Gyanamata because she was just past all of that. You know, she was just beyond the body. She was beyond the need for all that effort. And yet, every day, because Master said, she did a little bit of the energization exercises because he told her to. So that's what she would do, serving the Guru. It doesn't matter. Even if God himself is pleased, it makes no difference as long as the Guru is pleased. Now see, that was also, next week we'll talk about that. It's like she supremely understood the role of the Guru in the disciple's life. And just totally focused. Everything else was subservient to that. And that's what we'll talk about next week, so we don't need to go into it now. And that's it. We'll talk about everything next week. Okay, thank you.